This is Fresh Air. I'm Terry Gross. Ed White once summed up gay culture in America like this. Gays were oppressed in the 50s, liberated in the 60s, exalted in the 70s, and wiped out in the 80s. But now at the end of 1990, White has revised the last part of that statement. Gay culture, he says, is hardier than he realized. Ed White writes about gay culture in his fiction and journalism. His autobiographical novel, A Boy's Own Story, describes a gay boy's coming of age in the Midwest of the 50s. The Beautiful Room is Empty follows the story into the 60s as the boy becomes a man, moves to Greenwich Village, and participates in the birth of the gay liberation movement. White is planning two books that will continue the story into the 70s and the 80s, but first he's going to finish his biography of the French writer Jean Genet. White lived in Paris for most of the 80s, but returned last year. He will be profiled on the next edition of Public Television's AIDS Quarterly on November 26th. I found out he had returned to the States when I read a Time magazine profile. The headline said, "America's most influential gay writer is living and writing with AIDS." But the story said that White tested positive for the HIV virus, but didn't have any symptoms. It sounded like Time was incorrect in their diagnosis of AIDS.
I think they were. I'm fine, actually. I mean, my counts are good, and I think if I had never been tested, I never would have known. I'm as chubby as could be. I mean, I have plenty of energy. I'm dashing around, teaching, writing, traveling, as always. So it was, in fact, quite premature, and I think that, in fact, the writer, for Time, did a rather nice and well-rounded profile of me, and then it was an editor who really slapped on that sort of glaring headline.
Is that one of the drawbacks of letting people know that you test positive for HIV?
Absolutely. I mean, in England and in France, where I've discussed this subject because I felt that no one else was doing so, I felt that I'm not in any way being put into a little box, but in America, there's a way in which you get very quickly commodified. And so it's a sort of a question of whether I wanted to nevertheless come out and talk about being HIV positive, despite the fact of being commodified as a person living and dying with AIDS, or whether I just wanted to be silent about the issue altogether. And I finally decided, after talking it over with friends, that it was still better to be open.
Do you see HIV positive as being, you know, a death sentence?
No, I don't, and neither does my doctor. I mean, I think that it's too soon to say that. I think also that people who are living in relatively good health now with HIV, there's no reason to think that in a year or two or three that it won't become quite manageable, you know, like diabetes or other diseases.
Has seeing a lot of your friends die left you more death-obsessed?
I suppose. It's sort of left me... I alternate between being quite bereft and being rather hard-hearted. Mm-hmm. I mean, in other words, I think I go around being fairly selfish, I suppose, and trying to have the pleasures that I can have in my life and not wanting to know too much about the disasters all around me. But every once in a while, I mean, in fact, almost once a month, another really close friend of mine dies. And then oftentimes I'm asked to give the funeral address. And so it's all very painful.
Mm-hmm. So you moved to France in 1983. Why did you decide to leave New York?
Well, I won a Guggenheim, which allowed me to go to France. And once I got to France, I got a very good job with Condé Nast, writing for Vogue. And so, for the first time in my life, I was able to support myself working really only half-time as a journalist. And so it left me a lot of time to write, and I managed to write 2.5, 3 books, really, while living over there. And so that was one reason. I think another was that the whole New York that I had known had been a very, very exciting one that was very sexually oriented, and that had obviously come to an end with the beginning of AIDS. But it wasn't really that I left New York because of AIDS, because soon enough Paris became probably definitely the leading place for AIDS in Europe. So, and a lot of my French friends began to be ill and to die.
You said New York had been very sexually oriented. How did that compare to Paris?
Paris is still very sexually oriented in a way that New York isn't. I mean, I think the one reason that AIDS is such a problem in France is that straight people, for instance, have in no way changed their habits, and they simply don't want to hear about it. And gay people have not responded nearly as much as American gays have to to safe sex practices.
Writer Ed White is my guest. He's a novelist and journalist. He's the author of two autobiographical novels, A Boy's Own Story and The Beautiful Room is Empty. And several of his short stories are published in the book The Darker Proof. Why did you decide to come back to the States?
I got a very nice job offer. John Hawkes, the novelist, retired from Brown University, and he and a few other people in the English department wanted me to take his place. So I got a nice tenured professorship at Brown, and I came back with some trepidation. I didn't really know what I would think of living, especially in a small town, which I've never done before in my life. But I love it. I mind you, I'm living with two French friends, a man and a woman, who came over with me, and we seem to be surrounded by either French friends who come over from Paris or people in the French department at Brown. So we have our own little Parisian outpost there. But I find it really a very calm, quiet life.
How do you think America has changed in the years you've been gone? Do you feel a big difference?
I do. I feel that the questions of censorship, for instance, I mean, Robert Mapplethorpe was a friend of mine, and I think that there's even a section of me talking about him in the video tape that's been traveling around with the Mapplethorpe exhibit. And I can remember very well how he and I both felt that we were sort of pushing the limits in our writing and in our photography in the 70s. But it was definitely a very receptive atmosphere. Now I feel that that America has been really polarized by these questions of censorship, and that these puritanical issues have been brought up that seem to me totally spurious. I don't even think that the people who are advancing them believe in them.
Ed White is my guest, and he's a journalist and novelist. He's working on a new biography of Jean Genet. He's the author of several autobiographical novels and several short stories about AIDS. You're writing a biography of Jean Genet now. Tell me why you want to write a book about him. What interests you about the person and his writing?
Well, he's an absolutely fascinating person, and the life is an extraordinary one. If you think how popular the whole genre of literary biography has become, nevertheless, it's hard to sometimes figure out why it's so popular, because writers oftentimes have rather dreary lives.
Right, you sit at the typewriter and write, yeah.
Yeah. They, and particularly if they become famous young, then it's just sort of going from one honor to another, and it's not all that interesting. Mm. But in Genet's case, he was an orphan. He was he was sent off to Syria when he was a boy. He became male prostitute. He became a robber. He was a vagabond. Then all of a sudden, in his 30s, when he was in prison, he discovered he could write, and not write just like an ordinary person, but like a god. And he became really one of the most important writers in France, which was very quickly recognized by people like Cocteau, who really discovered Genet, and by Sartre, who wrote a 1,000-page book about him. So by the time he was 40, he had stopped writing his fiction, and he'd been consecrated as a sort of living saint. He then had two long periods of depression, one after he stopped writing his fiction, and then he came back and wrote his three great plays, The Blacks, The Screens, and The Balcony, and then he had another period of depression in which he tried to commit suicide, and then finally, starting in the late 60s, he became involved with politics, radical politics, namely the Black Panthers in America and the Palestinians, and on his deathbed, he was putting the finishing touches on his big mammoth book about those two political groups called The Prisoner of Love, which has yet to be brought out in America, but which was brought out in England with my introduction, and which has been an important publishing event in France, too.
What about his sexuality and the way he wrote about sex in his books?
Well, he was really one of the first people to write about it openly. People oftentimes mention Proust or Gide as antecedents, but if you think about it carefully, in Proust's novel, there are lots of homosexual characters, and in fact, virtually everyone except Proust, who continues to pose as a heterosexual. And in Gide, he does make rather veiled references about his sexuality in his journals, but the two books that he wrote about it that were quite explicit, he didn't even sign them. Nor did Cocteau sign his white paper, which was his big book about homosexuality. So in a way, what's remarkable and new about Genet is that this man in the 1940s sat down and wrote five brilliant novels, one right after the other, in which there's a character who is called Jean Genet, who is completely openly and fearlessly and defiantly homosexual.
Would you call his sexuality often brutal in some of his writing?
Yes, I think he's very interested in the whole question of sadomasochism in his writing, not particularly in his life. His relationships in life tend to be a lot more tender than the ones he describes in his books. Another thing that's interesting is that he had a tremendous number of very intimate, sometimes quarrelsome, but nevertheless always very strong friendships with women. Those relationships with women are almost never described in his fiction. So I would say that his fiction is much narrower than, and you might say purer, than his life.
Well, were you surprised to find that his relationships were more tender than the more brutal sex that he described in his writing?
I don't know. I sort of identify with him. I hope not too much. I try to remain objective about him. But, I mean, I can see that even sometimes in my own writing, I'll describe more S&M sex than or introduce more violence into my books than I would actually be able to tolerate in my life.
Why do you think you do it more in the fiction?
I think it is actually a kind of fantasy that lies under a lot of sexual acts that would appear rather peaceable to an observer. In other words, I think that there's a kind of interior and almost subconscious scenario that animates a lot of sexuality, not just gay, but straight as well. There's a psychiatrist called Stoller who began to do a lot of research into seemingly normal people's sexual fantasies, and he was struck by how many people whose sex life is actually quite normal in its obvious manifestations, nevertheless is animated by fantasies that deal a great deal with power and violence.
Do people assume that you, as a person, are more into things like pain than you are in real life because they've read your fiction and your characters desire that?
I find that I've changed tremendously in the last 8 years in general. One thing is I don't have very much promiscuous sex now, if ever, and I don't even particularly like the idea of it. And maybe it's because I'm very happy with the person I'm living with, but I think a lot of times people, I mean, probably other writers have had the same experience where you write rather racy things when you're in your 20s and 30s, and then when you're in your 40s or 50s, people still assume that you're this tremendous bounder. But so it isn't just the question of violence, it's the whole question of sexuality in general. I think I've become rather dully respectable in my old age.
You think that's a function of age?
Well, it's partly that, and it's partly, I think, the whole sexual climate today. I mean, I think that promiscuity, even if one wants to pursue it, it's very hard to do it. I think also, I mean, like I'm a teacher, and I've been a teacher before. I've never, so a lot of my contact is with students. I've never had a sexual contact with any student in all the years I've taught, and I wouldn't want to do that. I don't really approve of that.
Most of the writing that I've read of yours that's about AIDS has been in short story form, and those are the only short stories of yours I've read. Does the short story form seem right for what you want to say about AIDS?
Well, I hope to write two more volumes in this autobiographical series that began with The Boy's Own Story and went on to Beautiful Room is Empty. I would like to write a book about the 70s and another one about the 80s, and obviously the last one, the one about the 80s, will have to deal a great deal with AIDS. But up until now, I have in fact favored the short story form because I felt that there's something about the novel that leads almost inevitably to a tragic conclusion. I mean, in other words, if you write an AIDS novel, it's going to end in death. But the thing about a short story is that it allows one to have an odd angle of attack, to get into and out of a story or a situation or a particular nexus of characters rather quickly and unexpectedly.
Your autobiographical novel, The Beautiful Room is Empty, ends at the end of the 1960s. In fact, it ends at Stonewall, at the gay bar in New York that the police went in and busted, and the gays resisted. And this is considered, you know, one of the starting points of the gay liberation movement. Toward the end of the book, you write, "Then I caught myself foolishly imagining that gays might someday constitute a community rather than a diagnosis." You saw that happen in the 1970s.
Yes. Yes, definitely. And I think one of the things that I've really hated about AIDS is that it's threatened to re-medicalize a community that finally escaped its medical definition. In other words, the word homosexuality itself was invented by a doctor in the 1860s, and gays have almost, for the last 100-some years, have been considered a kind of medical phenomenon. And I think that what gay liberation did was really say that, no, we're something closer to an ethnic group than we are to a medical definition, a medical category. And but with the coming of AIDS, I think there's been a drifting back toward that sort of medicalization. I think, by the way, that's why it's very important for spokespeople to talk out about AIDS, people who actually either are HIV positive or who have full-blown AIDS. I think it's very important for people to talk about their experiences in a subjective way and to write about them and to make movies about them, because I think that otherwise all the public knows is what's told them by so-called experts. And I'm all for as much medical attention as we can possibly have. Obviously, it is a devastating medical situation. But I think what must not be lost sight of is the actual lives of people who are living their way through AIDS.
Mm-hmm. You wrote a book of journalism called States of Desire, Travels Through Gay America. And for that book, you went to cities around the country examining what the gay community was like there and how gay life differed from city to city around the country. And in part of that book, especially in the chapter about New York, you wrote about the back rooms of the gay bars where there was a lot of sex in those back rooms. Now, I'm wondering how that kind of heavy sex scene of the heavier gay bars looks to you now from 1990.
Well, I really can't say I regret it or feel bad about it or in any way regret it. I mean, I do feel that sex is one of the great pleasures in life, and I think if people are frank, most people would admit that's true. And I think that sex, always having the same kind of sexual experiences with the same partner, has certain wonderful advantages to it, perhaps, but it also has, I think, a lot of disadvantages. I mean, I think, in other words, a wide range of sexual experiences is very exciting for both men and women, both straight and gay people. But the curious thing is that I think there was only a very brief period in history, from, let's say, 1965 to 1980, when people could do that, let's say more or less 15 years in all of human history, when, for instance, I'm talking about a period after the pill was invented, when people were sufficiently sophisticated about antibiotics that they weren't completely destroyed by venereal disease, and before AIDS came along. So, in other words, we're talking about a very narrow time slot, and in that period, I think a lot of urban American young heterosexuals and homosexuals had a tremendous amount of sexual experimentation, which I think if they haven't had to die for it, they probably don't regret.
Mm-hmm. In States of Desire, you wrote that, on the question of why sex had become so important, you wrote, "With the collapse of other social values, religion, patriotism, family, sex has become our sole model for transcendence and our only touchstone of authenticity."
I think I've changed my attitude since I wrote that, however, in one way, and that is that I think I used to be much more of a kind of much more Freudian and totalizing, if you will, than I am now. In other words, I used to think that sex somehow summarized other experiences that we had or stood for all kinds of things. In other words, I imagine that the self was a very kind of unitary thing, and that if sex plays such a large role, it must do so because it represents large ambitions and interests of the self. But now I would say that why do we have to make a whole bunch of other symbolic needs go piggyback on the back of sex? In other words, why can't we just admit that it's an art in and of itself? It's something like an art or a pleasure or a form of self-expression, not so different from eating or listening to music. I mean, in other words, we don't, if somebody loves music, we don't demand what's purpose is this serving for him psychologically. We accept it as a kind of a taste that doesn't have to be integrated into the rest of the self. And I think sex is something like that, or should be.
What made you change your mind about that?
I think knowing Michel Foucault, who had a very strong argument against this sort of Freudian tendency to try to make big unities out of human traits.
Mm-hmm. In States of Desire, you wrote about gay men's prejudice against age. And I think that's something that must be changing from AIDS. Getting older is such a wonderful thing now. I mean,
yes, definitely, I think so. I mean, it was already beginning to change. Even before AIDS came along, there was already beginning to be important organizations like SAGE, which is a group for older lesbians and gays, in which a lot of very young people were participating as volunteers. I think as the sense of community becomes stronger, one accepts all the different members of that community, of whatever race they might belong to, whatever age they might be, and so on. And I think that it's true also, as you say, that now, with the coming of AIDS, there's so much of fear that not only will we individually be wiped out, but that our collective memory will be wiped out too. That whatever happened in the 40s, the 50s, the 60s will be completely forgotten. And so older people become very valuable as sources of information even about what gay experience was like in the past.
Thanks very much for talking with us.
Thank you, Terry.
Ed White has been my guest, and he's a journalist and novelist. And he'll be featured on the public television show The AIDS Quarterly, which will be on PBS November 26th. He's completing a biography of Jean Genet now. And he has several books, two autobiographical novels, A Boy's Own Story and The Beautiful Room is Empty. And there's a collection of short stories about AIDS, and he has about half of the short stories in that. And that book is called The Darker Proof. I'm Terry Gross, and this is Fresh Air.